Okay. So, welcome for our computer graphics lecture. And we are right now right in the middle of speaking about transformations. I think I told you that a large part of the rendering pipeline is transforming coordinates from one coordinate system to the other. And thus to map geometry, which is typically a triangle mesh, to screen space. And you also learned that we have a very nice machinery to describe that, and that is using homogeneous coordinates and matrices to describe all these single steps of our transformations. And in general, with such homogeneous matrices, we are able to describe projective mappings, which we will come to later on, maybe today, or I hope today. but we are right now looking at a subclass of these transformations, and that's affine mappings. And affine mappings essentially are just changes of coordinate systems. So it's a linear mapping and a translation. And we looked at certain classes of these affine mappings, and right now we are looking into rotations. And rotations is a special kind of coordinate system transformation because it just transforms to a new coordinate system, which again is orthonormal. So objects are not deformed under these transformations. And that's why it's a particularly interesting and important type of transformation. And in fact, it is necessary to look at this because our current way to describe this and that is using a matrix is not the best one to describe these transformations. It's perfect if you want to use that in your rendering pipeline to map objects. But for instance, if interpolation is required or user input is required to describe such a rotation, then we need other representations. And for the case of matrices, essentially, if we assume a rotation around the origin, then we have 9 degrees of freedom. That's essentially the linear part of the transformation. But 6 of these entries are fixed due to some constraints. Yeah? And that's very unintuitive. We are in a 9-dimensional space, and we take a 3-dimensional subset of this. For user interfaces, that's not very good to use. And an alternative, or a more intuitive way, are Euler angles. So probably the most easy or accessible example is the typical way that is used in aeronautics, that the position or the rotation of an airplane is described by 3 angles. I told you about this example last Thursday. And in fact, I made an error or a mistake. I mixed up pitch and yaw. So some student was told me that, and of course that's perfectly right. So we have to describe the position of an airplane in space. We have 3 angles. The first one is, I hope it's right now, yaw. So that's the direction, the flight direction, yeah, north, south, something like that. Then pitch is the elevation, whether the plane goes up or down, ascending or descending. And then we have roll, that's the rotation around the main axis. And that's a typical example that would be If our space is oriented like this, our world space, then we first have a rotation around Z, then we have a rotation around X, and then around Y. Yeah? So that's 3 angles. But of course, there are other possibilities to select different axes. That's just one that comes from an airplane, but you can imagine of any other of such systems. The only important thing is that of course, 2 successive rotations are not around the same axis. That doesn't make sense. Yeah? If I first rotate around X, then next I have to rotate around another axis. Yeah? Otherwise, I just split the first rotation angle to a sum. Okay, and a typical one is, for instance, that could be used is Z, Y, Z, or this whatever these angles were for the plane example. Okay, so that's another typical representation, but I also told you that example about interpolation, for instance. If we have an airplane that has this position, and then in the next frame or whatever, it should have this position. And now the problem is that if we directly interpolate Euler angles from this to this position, we won't get this movement that we expect, but instead we get something weird where first the yaw angle is interpolated and stuff like that, and then pitch and roll, so we get a very weird interpolation. And that's a typical example problem for interpolation of rotations. And something that is a bit that works better in that context is the representation that we use an axis and a rotation angle. So every rotation can be described by not a sequence of rotations around fixed axis, like here, z, y, z, but instead a single rotation around an arbitrary axis. Yeah? So again, we have 3 degrees of freedom. The first two are for the orientation of the axis. That's two-dimensional. And then we have a degree of freedom for the rotation angle. Yeah? So any rotation can be described by something like this, an axis and a rotation angle. OK, so how does that look like? Yeah? How can we, if we have that given, how can we rotate a point now? That's not too difficult. Let's look at this little illustration here. So n is our rotation axis. Yeah, P is a point or a vector that we want to rotate. And now the idea is the following. We can decompose or split P into a sum, P parallel and P perpendicular. And P parallel is parallel to the n, to the rotation axis. And P perpendicular, is perpendicular to it. That's quite simple to compute these two vectors. And now if we look at the rotation, we see that we can rotate P now simply by keeping P parallel fixed and only rotating P parallel. So that makes things a little bit easier. Yeah? So we decompose P into these two. P parallel is quite easy to compute. Yeah? We only have to project P onto N, that's the scalar product, as long as N is normalized. We assume that to be so. This times N gives us directly P parallel. Yeah? P parallel is mainly controlled here by the scalar product. And then P perpendicular is the difference between P and P parallel. That's simple. So then we rotate. So if we have P parallel, then we generate a new coordinate system. The idea behind that is now we want to rotate P parallel, and we can very easily do that in the right coordinate system. Our new coordinate system looks like that. First it takes N, yeah? Then it takes P parallel, or a vector parallel to this one, and the third, so these two are obviously perpendicular, by definition or by construction. And then we add a third vector, and that should be parallel, and we simply take the cross product between N and P parallel. Yeah? So this defines us a coordinate system. And the nice thing is now the rotation here only happens in these two vectors of that new coordinate system. So we can apply the standard rotation around one of the main axes of our coordinate system. Yeah, so we define a new local coordinate system using P perpendicular, so that's our new x-axis. The new y-axis is n cross p, that's this vector, where it's interesting also by construction n cross p and n cross p perpendicular are the same. I won't detail that in here, but it's the same. So this gives us a new vector here in this direction. And then N is the new z-axis. And so we transform to this new coordinate system. Then we rotate around our new z-axis, around N. Yeah? So this gives us a point on this circle here. And then we transform, or we simply go back to the original setup again. Yeah? So we do that transformation to that coordinate system, or we invert that, or go back to world space. OK, yeah? So create the new coordinate system, then rotate P about N, rotate here about N, and then if we have that one, that rotated point, we can go back again by adding P parallel. Okay, maybe I should. I mean, we implicitly go to that new coordinate system. So P in that new coordinate system, of course, is simply the coordinates of P in this new coordinate system are trivial, yeah, because it has no component of N, none of N cross P, and only this component here, P parallel, and then we do a simple rotation using this term here. That's a bit. I will afford an image for that. So this is P perpendicular. Yeah, and then we have this one. This is N cross P. And then the rotation will happen here on this circle. And now we have the setup. We have simply this vector, and we want to rotate it to this vector. This is omega, and this vector is just cosine omega P perpendicular plus sine omega N cross P. Yeah? Okay, good. So that's this rotation. So this gives us this rotated vector, and if we now add P parallel again, then we have the rotated point. Yeah? So that's the rotation here. Yeah, and now all the ingredients we need are known. P perpendicular is this here. Where is it? This here. P parallel is this here. Okay, so we can compute P parallel. From this, we can compute P perpendicular. The cosine and the sine of the angle have to be computed, and that's it. Yeah? All the ingredients are here. Okay, so that can be computed quite easily. Now the interesting question, can we express this in a matrix? Yeah, ideally, we want to have our representation using an axis and an angle, and for rendering or whatever, we want to transform it to a matrix so that we can plug it into our machinery. And in fact, that's maybe more simple than one might think in the very beginning. So first of all, if we look at P parallel, yeah, that's this term here that projects P onto this axis. Yeah. We will see that this can be described by this matrix. This matrix time P delivers this expression here. Yeah, just have to multiply out, and then we get this matrix, and this matrix is known as the outer product of N. Yeah? The inner product would be NT, scalar product with N, so that's the inner product, it generates a scalar, but if we do it the other way around, we also get a matrix, a 3x3 matrix, and this is exactly that matrix that does this mapping. So P parallel is just this matrix time P. So that's known. We can express this as a matrix, and the cross product can also be expressed by a matrix. And that's this matrix here. This is called this Q-symmetric form of N. Yeah? Also, the cross product is such a linear mapping on this point. Yeah? So we call that Q. And if we plug that into this formula here now, yeah, we can express this here as a matrix multiplied with P. So putting all that together, we have this matrix is P, that's in fact this part. Yeah. P parallel is P times P. Yeah? So the rotation is described by this matrix. This generates P parallel. This here generates this part, yeah, P perpendicular is P minus P parallel, and this times cosine results in this here. Yeah, that's P minus P parallel times the cosine, and this is the cross product. This here, this cross product is expressed by the matrix Q times the sine. Well, okay, maybe if you write it down, you make one intermediate step, then you will see that this is directly expressed using that matrix. Yeah? So that's a quite simple way. We take the rotation axis, compute the outer product, that's P, and we compute this Q symmetric form, that's Q, and then we can directly combine that and get a matrix. And this can even be carried a bit further. We won't have a proof here, but a typical way to describe such rotations is not to take a normalized direction or normalized rotation axis and an angle, but instead to use a single vector. And now the length of this vector is the rotation angle, yeah, and the normalized W is the axis. Yeah, so we kind of combined code the rotation angle and the axis to a single vector. And this is quite convenient in many cases, and if we do so, it can be shown that directly this form here is the rotation matrix that describes this rotation. I won't show us a proof here. Q is just this Q symmetric form of the normalized axis, yeah, and then this here is directly the rotation matrix. Okay, yeah, so rotation axis and angle can quite simply be transformed to such a matrix. Of course, it would also be different to do that more explicitly, what I described here, and this is by depending on the axis. So let's say this is our rotation axis. We can simply generate a new coordinate system which takes this axis and then two other perpendicular vectors. Yeah. So let's call them u and v. So if we have any point, we transform it into that coordinate system, and then we can do a rotation, for instance, around z and transform back. Well, that's just form a new orthonormal basis, u, v, w, where the last axis is the normal, and u and v are just two perpendicular vectors. So we have some degree of freedom to choose these, which makes it even a bit more difficult, because now we need an if clause to compute an arbitrary vector that is perpendicular to W. Yeah? So you have n given, and now we need some arbitrary vector that is perpendicular to n. That's not that very simple. okay, I won't need to detail that. Yeah? But if we have that, then it's very simple, because then we can generate a matrix that directly does this coordinate transformation. We spoke about that. Then we can transform the point into this new system. Then we do the rotation around the z-axis, and then we transform back. And as a result, we get this here. Yeah? Okay, just another way to achieve the matrix that is exactly the same as what you get here, by the way. Yeah, it's exactly the same. It's just another way to describe that. Maybe more intuitive, but you have that problem how to choose U. Okay, now, of course, the interesting question also the other way around. Given a matrix, you know that it's a rotation matrix, how can I find this representation of an axis and an angle? And in fact, it's maybe a very nice way to realize that or to explain what eigenvalues and eigenvectors are, because it's quite easy to see that if I have that matrix M, yeah, I know it's a rotation around some axis. I don't know which axis. But what I know is that if I take a point on the axis, yeah, some point here, and I rotate that, then obviously it won't change its position. Yeah? So what will happen is this. So the axis or points on the axis are all the points that fulfill this. And of course it's clear that this means just it's the eigenvectors using or having the eigenvalue 1. So if I have that matrix, yeah, and if I know it's a rotation matrix, I can compute the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, and I take the eigenvector corresponding to the eigenvalue 1. Yeah, and that must be the rotation axis. And so that's typical eigenanalysis, and even the angle can quite easily be computed, because if we add some further knowledge about how these matrices look like, we can find out that the trace, so that means just the sum on the diagonal of M, must be 1 plus 2 cosine omega, and from this we can directly, from the trace, compute the rotation angle. Yeah? Okay. Good. So that's one possibility to describe rotations in a nice way. But whenever you look into descriptions of how to represent rotations well, then you will always end up finding quaternions. Yeah? They are the means to describe rotations, and they are used in every computer game and so on. So obviously they are very, very... Once you understood how they work or accept how they work, then it's a quite convenient means to describe rotations. And the motivation or the idea for quaternions is the following. I assume that all of you already heard about complex numbers. Is this the case? I think so, yeah. Okay. Good. So the idea of complex numbers is simply to carry real numbers to two dimensions. Yeah? So we get an additional axis, which is called I. So we have our complex numbers. They have two components, two parts, a scalar and another scalar. And addition, so these complex numbers, again, form a field. So you can do computations as you're used to doing that with real numbers. And one interesting thing is that multiplication with these complex numbers is a rotation. So that means if you have a complex number, like for instance this here, let's write this as a vector, and now you take any other number and you multiply these two numbers, yeah, what you get is that this point is rotated, and it's exactly rotated by this angle. So if this is angle alpha, then a multiplication rotates this point by an angle of alpha. It also performs multiplication on the length, but that's not so important for now. Yeah, multiplication with complex numbers means rotation. Yeah, that's the core observation. And yeah, maybe it is important because multiplication means also that the lengths are multiplied. So that means you can express any rotation in 2D by multiplication with a unit length complex number. Yeah? Because this unit length means don't change the length, but only change the angle. Yeah? So that's a rotation. Okay, so in 2D, complex numbers would be fine, but as I told you, 2D rotations are very simple anyhow. Yeah? So they are not problematic. You only have one single angle. So there's not much to think about. But in fact, this idea can be carried further to quaternions. Now, quaternions use exactly the same idea as complex numbers, but instead of adding one single imaginary number, an entire vector is added, or three new imaginary parts are added. Yeah, and we do not only have I, but we have I1, I2, and I3. Yeah, so we could say, yeah, we add a vector, a 3D vector, as imaginary part. Yeah, so our numbers now have four components, x, y1, y2, and y3. Okay. Of course, now there's a lot you can think about that. There are rules how to multiply these numbers, how to add, how to find norms, and do all the typical stuff that you want to do. And I won't go into details for that. So for instance, addition is obvious. It's just adding the real and imaginary parts. Yeah. Now remember, this is a vector, essentially. Yeah. B is a vector and D is a vector. And there's a product. The product can be defined. That's already a bit more complicated. But it works. Yeah? And there are rules. For instance, or something that also is used for complex numbers, by negating the imaginary part, you get the conjugate, and the norm of a quaternion, for instance, then can be computed like that, and this allows us also to compute the inverse, and stuff like that. If you look that up, you will find pages of rules how to compute with these quaternions, like you are used to do computations with other in other fields. Now, the interesting thing is that it turned out that these quaternions obviously have a very nice relationship to rotations in 3D space, or that the group, the mathematical group of rotations in 3D, and these quaternions have a very nice mapping. Yeah? So in fact, I don't know which was invented first, yeah, whether it was first the rotations that mapped to the invention of quaternions or the other way around. I would guess the other way around. And this works like that. So consider again that you have a quaternion. And as for this example here, yeah, this was a unit length complex number. And now for quaternions, we also need a unit length quaternion. So that's a quaternion with length 1, obviously. Okay. It's a 4D vector, and we have the constraint that it has unit length, so we have three dimensions of freedom. So that already maps with our rotations. And now, with that quaternion Q, we can rotate a vector, and we can do that in the following form. So first, we have a vector v, yeah. That's that's from R3, from 3D space. So first of all, we transform this vector to a quaternion, like this, yeah. So we make this vector the imaginary part of that quaternion, and as real part, it gets a zero. That's very simple, yeah. And then we apply the quaternion Q in that way, yeah. So we take this vector, and to the right we multiply the inverse of Q, and to the left we multiply Q. Okay, now that's magic. That's kind of what we have to accept for now. And now the interesting thing is that if we do that, we get a new vector. So if we make V a quaternion, then we multiply Q to the right and to the left. This gives us a new quaternion, yeah? That's quaternion times quaternion times quaternion. So that gives us a new quaternion. And this will always have a zero in the real part. And the imaginary part now is V rotated, yeah, by a certain amount. Yeah. And so the result is a rotation of V. And yeah, whatever we plug into, Q always represents one particular rotation. Yeah? So any rotation, obviously, or every unit length quaternion describes one rotation if we apply Q in that way here. And yeah, it can be shown, in fact, that it also works the other way around. For every rotation, there's one, there's a quaternion describing exactly this rotation. Yeah, so there's a one, or there's a mapping between quaternions and rotations, and it can easily, or it can be shown that the relation is the following. So if we have a rotation around about axis n and an angle omega, this quaternion here describes exactly this rotation. Yeah. So the imaginary part is the rotation axis times the sine of the rotation angle, of the half rotation angle, and the real part is the cosine of half the rotation angle. Yeah? So if you have an axis and an angle, with this formula you can immediately compute a quaternion from that. Yeah? This quaternion. And with this quaternion and this formula, you can easily rotate vectors now. That's a kind of other way, another way to apply a rotation around an axis and an angle, yeah, is to compute that quaternion and then apply this quaternion rotation. Okay, now I was always tempted to say that there's a one-to-one mapping between rotations and quaternions, and in fact, it's not really true. It's a kind of two-to-one mapping. And this is because Q and minus Q describe the same rotation. Yeah, this can easily be seen if I negate the angle, yeah, and negate the axis. So that means instead of rotating around this axis by some angle, I rotate about this axis by the negative angle. That's exactly the same rotation. Yeah, rotation axis, changing the axis of orientation or negating the axis of rotation means just negating the angle, and then you get exactly the same rotation. So this we can also see here. So there's always two quaternions describing the same rotation, and the other way around, every rotation can be described by two quaternions, unit length quaternions. Okay, but nevertheless, yeah, we have a nice mapping between these quaternions and rotations. And so as I said, this is a very, very common way to describe rotations. So to describe such a rotation, this quaternion here is stored. It's four values. And then we can apply a rotation using this formula here. Yeah. The necessary inverse you can find here. Yeah? And here you already see if Q is a unit length quaternion, then the inverse is just the conjugate, and the conjugate just means negate the vector part. Yeah? So this all becomes quite simple. So this here is just the conjugate. So that's not difficult to compute. Okay, so, I mean, for now, that's just another way to describe rotations. Yeah, up to now, we had representations that we could convert to a matrix, and we can apply a rotation by multiplying that matrix to the vector. So now we have just another way to compute exactly the same. Yeah, we just express this rotation using quaternions. So you might say, okay, what have we won? What we want is that this representation here, this quaternion representation, can very well be used for interpolation. And these quaternions can now be interpolated in a way that avoids exactly that problem that I told you about using Euler angles. So for Euler angles, as I said, it could happen that if you want to interpolate from here to here, you don't get this direct movement that you would expect, but instead you get something very weird. Yeah? For quaternions, this doesn't happen. And you can directly take such a quaternion or two quaternions, Q1 and Q2, and interpolate between these two. And this gives a very smooth and direct movement. And it can be even carried further. You can take many of these different rotations and then define smooth polynomial spline paths or whatever. And this gives a very smooth animation without typical problems of Euler angles. There's only one thing that has to be considered, and that's now the interpolation of quaternions, or to be more precise, of unit quaternions, because that's exactly the same problem like with interpolating normals. I already spoke about that a few times. So if you have two normals, N1 and N2, and you interpolate between these two linearly, you get an interpolation that does not have unit length anymore. And I also told you that if we do that interpolation linearly, then the kind of rotation speed is not uniform. Yeah? It's moving faster when we're here about at the half and getting slower at the ends. And for the quaternions, exactly the same is true. Yeah? So if we have quaternion Q1, now it's a bit difficult, yeah, because Q1 is a 4D vector, which is difficult to display on a 2D slide, but it doesn't matter, yeah. So that's a 4D unit length vector. That's a 4D vector, and now we do linear interpolation. Obviously, all the points in between are no longer have unit length. And we get, even if we renormalize, we get non-uniform velocity, but there's a quite simple way to solve that. And in fact, that would also work for this problem. Yeah, and that's this non-uniformity can be described, yeah, and can be compensated. And that's what we call spherical interpolation. Yeah? Spherical interpolation is a way to interpolate unit vectors, be it in 2D, 3D, 4D, whatever you want. So it works for normals, and it also works for quaternions. And now the interpolation formula here is a bit more complicated, and in particular it contains the sign, which is, yeah, not too nice because the sign is a bit more expensive, but for the typical applications, yeah, where you don't have to do that per pixel, but only once per object, that's negligible. So, yeah, this formula here interpolates two unit vectors, Q1 and Q2, and by construction, each of the intermediate interpolated vectors is again a unit vector, and this interpolation also guarantees that on this trajectory here, there's a uniform velocity. Yeah? So we really elegantly and very uniformly interpolate between Q1 and Q2. There's one. This angle here, omega, is the angle between Q1 and Q2. Sorry, I forgot that here in the image. Yeah. So here, this angle, this is omega. Okay, good. And using this spherical interpolation, now we can really elegantly, we can use that to elegantly interpolate rotations. Okay. Good. So that would end my description of rotations. Of course, I'm open for questions, and I hope you don't hesitate if something is not clear on that. Okay, so next we will now have a look at our homogeneous matrices. And now we will leave the space of affine transformations. Yeah, and as I told you, affine transformations can be described by such a homogeneous matrix where in the bottom row we have 0, 0, 0, 1. And now, of course, you should ask yourself, okay, what happens if I put other values down here? Yeah, if I replace the 0001 by something else. Yeah, and yeah, for now I added a 1 here, just for a simple reason. Due to the properties of homogeneous coordinates, you will see that if you multiply the entire matrix by a constant factor, the mapping won't change. Yeah, because if you multiply that entire matrix by 2, the resulting vectors will be multiplied by 2, and dehomogenization cancels out this 2 again. Yeah, so in fact, we only have 15 degrees of freedom, and we sort of fix that by setting the lower right entry to 1. That does not always make sense. We will see matrices where this is 0. Yeah? but just to explain, yeah, that we have only 3 degrees of freedom that make the difference between affine and projective. Okay, yeah, so what happens if we also use this line here? And yeah, in fact, it is exactly what we need, because that's what we will use to describe perspective projections. And maybe to help you to remember that, a perspective projection is, yeah, I mean, you all know that, yeah? Perspective projection of a cube, for instance, would look like this. That's a very extreme example. Yeah, and obviously, such a perspective projection is not affine. Why? One property of affine mappings is that parallel lines remain parallel. And obviously, that's not the case here. Yeah, so these two lines are parallel in world space, but in the image, they are not. Yeah. Okay, so how does perspective work? So there's a typical image that is used for that. And the nice thing is that it's from a person from Nuremberg, so it's from Albrecht Dürer. And he explained perspective in the following way, that, okay, you take a hook at the wall, and yeah, that will be your eye. Yeah, so you can try to apply that hook to your eye, but it's better to the wall. And now you take a string, so that's the object that you want to draw. Yeah, and now you take a string from that hook, and you fix it at a particular point of the object that you want to draw, and the string goes through a frame here. This will be your canvas in the end. Yeah? And in order to be able to put that string through here, this canvas can be moved to the side, yeah, so that it directly goes through here. And then you kind of remember the position where that string would intersect your canvas. In fact, there are little strings here so that you have kind of grid to be able to remember that position. Yeah, then you remove that string, you put the canvas here again and make a point directly at that position. Yeah, so that's a bit difficult construction. Yeah, but if you have a cube here with 8 vertices, that's sort of doable. And if you do so, yeah, what you get is a perspectively perfect image of that cube. And this image will exhibit all these properties, so parallel lines do not remain parallel, and so on. Another way to, and I think I already explained that, another way to see that is the following. Okay, so assume or take a piece of glass. Yeah. So let's assume this is glass. And now I just hold it in front of me, and I take a pencil, and I mark every point on this screen exactly in the color that I see through this screen. Yeah, so I really make lots of dots all in the color that I see right at that moment. And if I'm done, of course, I can move that canvas. Yeah, and I will always see the original image. Yeah, that's trivial. I just copied what I see to that screen, Yeah, and if I move that around, now I have a perfect image. And that's exactly that construction here. Yeah, it's just that this canvas is replaced by a glass screen, and instead of remembering that position, I just mark that point with the color I see through the glass. That's exactly the same construction. Okay, and this is how perspective works. It's as simple as that. So it's a simple point projection. Yeah, we project every point in our 3D world onto our 2D canvas by drawing a line from that point to one single center of projection. And the intersection of that line with the canvas is the projection of our point. Yeah? Okay. And now the interesting thing is that it can be shown that, of course, this, as I said, this is not an affine mapping, yeah, because parallel lines do not remain parallel. But if we look in homogeneous coordinate space, it turns out that this projective transformation is an affine, and even more, it's a linear transformation on homogeneous coordinates. That means this mapping here, yeah, can be described by a simple homogeneous matrix. So I can compute this transformation by using my point x, y, z, adding homogeneous coordinate 1, and then applying such a 4x4 matrix. Yeah? And this and dehomogenization. And essentially that means, yeah, obviously, because then obviously that means if we here add values different from 0, we get the projective transformations. Projective and perspective is one particular or just another term for projective transformations. Okay, yeah, so this is what we will call projective transformations. We take homogeneous coordinates and we allow arbitrary values in here, and this class we describe as projective transformations. And of course, projections are a superclass of affine transformations. Yeah? 0, 0, 0 here means affine, otherwise it's not affine. Okay, and these projective transformations now also have properties. So obviously, since they are, or what I described here, one property obviously is that parallelity is not maintained. Parallel lines do not maintain or remain parallel. But there's another, maybe even more important property, and that is that these mappings always map lines to lines. And that's very important. Because that means, in our rendering context, that if we have a triangle and we apply that projective mapping, the result, again, is a triangle. Yeah? And that's very, very important for us, because that was always our assumption. Yeah? We have a triangle in 3D space, and we map it to the screen, and then we always assume that the mapping, again, is a triangle. And these projective mappings do so, and most perspective, it is also true. Yeah, every camera maps lines to lines unless, you have problems with your lens, or maybe a special lens like a fisheye lens. Yeah, that does not fulfill that, and in fact, these lenses cannot represent it by such a projective transformation. So in computer graphics, if you want to generate a fisheye lens rendering, then you really have to scratch your head and think about new approaches that won't be able with that matrix machinery. That matrix machinery can only simulate cameras that map lines to lines. Okay, so it maps lines to lines, and in fact, it's the largest class that does so. Every mapping that maps lines to lines is also projective. And the other way around. Yeah? So that's the probably most important way or best way to describe projective transformations. Then we know parallelity is not preserved. Another thing that will become important later is that ratios are not preserved. That means if I take, it's on the next slide. And also an interesting property, it can map points to infinity and vice versa. That means it includes points at infinity, and any point somewhere here in 3D space can be mapped to infinity and also the other way around. That's a bit, it will have consequences, but it's also sometimes quite convenient. So for instance, you know that the distinction between point light sources and parallel light sources, and with homogeneous coordinates you can just say a point light source is just a parallel light source at infinity. And we spoke about that. So we parallel light sources have a homogeneous component of zero. And now there are mappings that really transform a parallel light source to a point light source and the other way around. So that there's sometimes surprising things happen. Okay, and now I promised you an image. There will be one, but it's on the next slide set. Sorry for that. So what does ratios are not preserved mean? Let me come back to this. That just means if I have a line and I take the midpoint of that line and I map these three to a perspective view, let's say I get this now, and now the projection of this point will be on that line. Lines are mapped to lines, so every point here will be mapped to this line again, but it will not be in the center. That's a kind of part of the perspective, that this point here in the center in the projection will end up here. So this ratio here, it's 1:1, and here it's something different, q:1. Okay, that's also a typical property of projective mappings. Affine mappings keep ratios. Maybe you remember that. That was also one of the things we spoke about. Okay, good. So that's the general class of projective mappings. And in fact, so probably I already mixed it up a few times. Projective and perspective mappings, that's the same. Perspective, as we know it, is just projective mappings applied to seeing, or applied to cameras. So perspective and projective mapping are the same. And here now is another way that shows this. It's exactly the same what is also done here, or this observation, how an image can be generated, is kind of transformed to a machine or what we now call camera with this very simple device. And in fact, this is not really a device, it's really a room. In Italian or in Latin, a camera. So it's a room and it has a small hole in one wall. And in fact, that's a camera. And why is it so? So let's assume you have an object here and this object emits light. And now all these light beams, or a very little fraction of these light beams, penetrates this hole here and it crosses this room, and on the opposite wall, exactly the light beam coming from here will be reflected here at that point of the wall, and the light beam with a certain color from here will end up here. And what you will see here on the back wall is just an image of that object, but upside down and left right changed. And now, of course, you don't, in practice, you could construct that, but ask your landlord before you drill a hole in the wall. And that will work, but the image here will be very, very dim, very dark. Yeah? Because if this hole here is too small, then it's only very little light getting in. And if you make the hole larger, then the image will get brighter but also unsharp. Yeah? And if the hole is just too big, you just get a bright spot here and you cannot recognize detail. But if you make that hole smaller and smaller, the image here gets sharper and sharper. And okay, now we can try. So obviously that's something that generates images, and of course that's also the way how a normal camera works. The only difference is that this small hole here is replaced by a set of lenses. And these lenses are constructed in a way such that this hole can be made bigger. Yeah? That's the entire purpose of a lens. This hole can be made bigger, and nevertheless all rays coming from a certain point converge at a single point back here again. Yeah? But nevertheless, this is what also is called the pinhole model of a camera. Very well approximates most cameras. Yeah? There are differences, but for now this will be absolutely sufficient. Yeah? Okay. And of course now, in fact, if you look at this image and this image, yeah, with some imagination you realize that it's exactly the same. The only difference is that this hook here becomes a hole in the wall, and the canvas here is not here, but instead it's behind the wall. Yeah? Otherwise, it's exactly the same, and this one will generate an upright image, and this one will generate an image upside down, yeah? If you have it behind the hole. That's all the difference. But on a computer, that's no problem. It just means negating coordinates, and then we are fine again. Okay, so that can be built, yeah, and that obviously works, and that was also a key idea or a key invention to understand how perspective works. I find that a bit surprising. Yeah, Egyptians were able to build pyramids and really impressive things. But obviously, they didn't understand perspective. Yeah? So that's why they always draw people like that. They have no idea about perspective. And I think understanding perspective is easier than building a pyramid. But so it took quite long until the first images have been drawn that show perspective. So these are examples. Yeah, you see 15th century. So that's a quite simple perspective, but you can already see this observation here, yeah, in the tiles here on the ground. So obviously that's perspective. Here on the left, that's not too well visible. But here you can also see kind of perspective here on the tiles at the roof. And also here, yeah, that's but that's much later. It's a one-point perspective, so all parallel lines here, they come together or they vanish in a point back here. We will see also that in a minute, where that comes from. Yeah, so it took quite long for people to understand that. Now this perspective has properties that you all know. Objects appear smaller the further they are away. Yeah, that's a typical effect. I mean, that can easily be described now with this pinhole model, for instance, or the other models that we have. So if this is my eye, we will always describe it or show it illustrated with a camera. Now, this is the glass that I keep in front of my eyes. I think that's the best image that we will take in the future. So that's my image or my screen. And then we have something behind here, for instance, a cube. And we directly project this onto our screen, yeah, and then we get here the image. And if we move that object further away, it is clear that this image will become smaller. Yeah? So that's obvious. And of course, it will get bigger if we get closer. Yeah? But then there's also something else, or another observation that is interesting, and that is that lines parallel in world converge to a single point in image space. Yeah? And perspectives are typically described now or distinguished by the number of vanishing points for the main axis. So let me show this with a simple example. Now that's a typical one-point perspective. Maybe that one here on the right is even better. You see there's one vanishing point. All these lines, all these parallel lines, they vanish in that point back here. And if you think about a little bit about that, that's just an instance of what I told you, that points at infinity are mapped to points, to finite points. Because all these parallel lines, they kind of converge at infinity. Yeah? That's what how you can also describe parallelity. They don't intersect, or they only intersect at infinity. And if you take now this point at infinity and you apply a projective mapping in this image, this point ends up in a finite point. Yeah? So all these parallel lines now are no longer parallel, but if you also add infinity, then all these lines intersect somewhere, and now it's just visible, that part. That's another typical one-point perspective. And it's only one point because if you look at the other main axis, for instance, these here, the up axis, they remain parallel. Yeah? And the other ones would be, now here in this back building, these lines, they also remain parallel. It's only one of the axes that generates or that converges in a vanishing point. That's a typical two-point perspective. Now these lines converge in a vanishing point back here. These lines converge in a vanishing point back here. And these lines, they remain parallel. Yeah, so that's why it's a two-point perspective. And three-point, that's another example for a two-point perspective. And for the three-point perspective, we don't have an example, but I can draw a cube for you. I think it gets complicated. So we will need this. Then here we have another vanishing point. And then we need another one somewhere up here where these converge, so we get something like this. Okay, so that would be a three-point perspective of a cube. Yeah? Okay, good. And in fact, this can be distinguished on how the main axes are positioned relative to the projection plane. So one-point perspective means that two axes are parallel to the projection point. Two-point perspective means that one is parallel, and in a three-point perspective, none is parallel to the projection plane. Just as a kind of side remark. And here again, this remark, the idea or the point here, what happens here is that just points at infinity are mapped to finite points. And that means that this vanishing point, which in 3D world is at infinity, is mapped now to a finite point in our image. That's all that happens with these vanishing points. And that's this concept now can very easily be understood using homogeneous coordinates, because I already told you at one point, I think, that a point with homogeneous coordinate 0 describes a point at infinity. You can easily see that if you take an arbitrary point, x, y, an arbitrary point, and then you reduce the homogeneous coordinate towards 0, and I just realized that this should be... x, w, y, w, z, w. Yeah? So independent of W, you remember, after dehomogenization, that describes an arbitrary point or a particular point x, y, z, yeah, independent of W. And if we reduce W and go to zero, my correction was wrong. Okay. Now, if we look at that example, yeah, we take the point x, y, z with homogeneous coordinate 1, and now we reduce 1. So what happens is that this point moves outwards, away from the origin. Yeah? If we have 1/3, for instance, after dehomogenization, you get 3x, 3y, 3z. Yeah? And the smaller w gets, the further we go out here. And if w is 0, then we are at infinity. Yeah? So obviously, the point x, y, z, 0 is the point at infinity in this direction. So that's also why kind of this here is a direction instead of this with w larger than or unequal to 0 is a point. Now, this is a direction. Yeah, we'll also come back to that later. Now, we naturally have that difference between points and vectors. Yeah, so this is a vector, can be interpreted as a vector. Yeah, so points at infinity are just normal homogeneous points. Yeah, they just have the special property that their last component is zero. But for a homogeneous coordinate, they are nothing special. And now, if we now apply an arbitrary matrix, it can happen that such a point is mapped to a point. So such a point at infinity is mapped to a finite point. That just means that its W component becomes a value different from 0, and the other way around. Yeah? Any point can be mapped to infinity and the other way around. Yeah? So there's no distance, no difference between these anymore. And as I told you, yeah, now we have kind of the difference. We could also interpret this as the difference between points and vectors. And in fact, that naturally happens. So what we can say that we interpret this as a direction. That will come later. That's now a description of vanishing points. As I said, vanishing point is the image of a point at infinity. And such points at infinity can be described by such directions here. And all parallel lines have a common direction. Yeah? And a vanishing point is just the image of this direction. And now if we look at such a mapping, A, that's a 4x4 matrix, and we want to now determine what this is a perspective projection and where are the vanishing points. Yeah? We kind of want to construct these vanishing points here from a given matrix. Yeah? Now we will see that this is quite simple, because if we want to see where all lines parallel to the x-axis, so let's say this is the x-axis, yeah? And now we want to find out where all these points converge, what we do is that we just take this point, that's the point at infinity where all these parallel lines intersect, yeah? Where they come together. And we directly send this point through our matrix, or not this one, this one, yeah, that's the x direction. We just send that through our matrix, and the image is that vanishing point. And now, multiplying with that matrix simply means that we take the first column of A. Yeah? So if our matrix looks like this, in fact, this is the vanishing point for the points in x direction, vanishing point x direction, yeah. This is the vanishing point in y direction, and this is the vanishing point in z direction. Yeah? So that's playing with formulas, but I just find it very, very elegant. And the very nice thing is or the nice thing is, by counting the values unequal to zero down here, you find out whether it's a one-point perspective, a two-point perspective, or a three-point perspective. And you only have zeros down here. Yeah, you have a kind of zero-point perspective. That means you have no vanishing points at all. And yeah, in fact, this is not perspective anymore. This is affine. Yeah? Having zero here and here and here, we are back in the class of affine mappings. Okay, I mean, I like that stuff. I hope I don't bore you too much with that. Good. Okay. We will come back to this later on when we explicitly construct these matrices, yeah, when we will see how these matrices look like for a given camera with given focal length and stuff like that. Yeah, we will come back to that in a minute. For now, we only wanted to describe what you can do with these 4x4 matrices and that they are a very elegant way to bring all these things together and to describe all these mappings that we want to have. And if we go back now to our setup in computer graphics, remember that we have a number of different mappings. And now here, just an overview again, what these mappings do. And in fact, of course, these mappings always map from one coordinate system to the next one. And so our coordinate systems that we essentially have is that first we start in object space. Yeah, that's modeling coordinates. Then we position these objects in our world. So we transform to world coordinates. Yeah, so that's the first mapping. And here we typically use rotations and translations and maybe also scalings. And then we transform our world to a camera space. So that's a space that is local to our current camera. We will see why that is sort of convenient, because after that, yeah, we now have a very simple setup. We always have our camera or our virtual eye in the origin. We always look typically along the z-axis. Typically along the minus z-axis to have a right-handed coordinate system, but that's a minor issue. And y always points up and x points to the right. Yeah, so that's a very convenient setup. But also this mapping is affine or even rigid. Yeah, so nothing is kind of deformed yet. And now we have from there on. Now we have to add perspective. Yeah? Now we have to kind of do these weird transformations where parallel lines get deformed and are no longer parallel and stuff like that. And this mapping from here to a space to screen space, yeah, where we directly can address pixels, this mapping is called the projection. And this is a projective transformation. It's such a matrix here. It is not affine, so it has entries down here, and we will see, not today, but hopefully on Thursday, how these matrices can here be generated. Okay, and then after that, we have screen space coordinates. Good. So much on transformations in general, and of course, I think that was just... Of course, I'm open for questions before we will look into details now how we apply all this directly for our purpose in computer graphics. No questions? Okay. Good. So, viewing and projection. How do we apply all this now in our rendering pipeline? So as I already described these different coordinate systems that we have. And in fact, now if we also separate these transformations to different stages, to different parts, then we can now already refine our graphics pipeline a little bit. So if you look at the first versions of the graphics pipeline, I had all these transformation stuff in one box. Yeah, and now we here split up these different coordinate system transformations to different boxes here. And yeah, we also changed things a little bit because you see now this transformation part has been separated. So first of all, we have modeling transformations. Then we have viewing transformations. And then the next transformation does not happen immediately. But first of all, here we do shading and illumination computation. Why is this the case? So we could immediately apply all these transformations one after the other, yeah, this, this, and this, in one single matrix. But as we learned here, on one of these images, in particular, this last one here is a projective mapping. That means parallel lines, for instance, do not remain parallel, and also angles are not maintained in a very difficult to control way. And that means if we do a lighting computation after this projection, yeah, we will get wrong results. Yeah, it's just vectors that are normal are no longer normal, and directions can change, and angles between directions can change, and so on. So doing the shading computation here is too late, and we typically do it in a space that is not deformed yet. So shading happens here, and then we have the normalization transformation. Then we will have a step called clipping. We will speak about that in the next chapter, what it does. Then we have rasterization. That's what we learned. And then finally, we can do the display. Yeah. So refined version of our graphics pipeline. OK, good. So now, here, modeling transformations. This is essentially, as I told you, it's just to position objects in space. That means we have a rotation and a translation and maybe a scaling. We spoke a lot about rotations, how we can describe the position of an object in the world. So that's sort of handled. Yeah, we will come back to that later on. But now, for now, from a transformation point of view, that's fine. So next, we will look at this viewing part and at this projection part. And these two, they always, you start with a world in 3D space, and you want to generate a 2D image from that. And we saw here with pinhole camera and stuff like that how this can happen to get such a perspective image. Educational reasons, and also because it's used in practice, we also have to look at another projection, which is called the orthographic projection. And this, in fact, is such a kind of a zero vanishing point projection. It's a projection that no natural camera can generate. Yeah, I mean, maybe it would be possible to build a device that generates something like that, but it would look very different from a camera you're used to. And so what you see here, it's also called parallel perspective, because all parallel lines remain parallel. Yeah, it's a kind of first way to learn perspective, but it's not real perspective, yeah, because all parallel lines remain parallel. This is a kind of subclass. We will also be able to describe that with this here. But what we will really be interested in is this perspective projection. Okay, so these parallel images, how are they generated? Well, they are called orthographic because they are generated by parallel projection. Yeah, or by orthographic projection. So imagine you have here this cube. This is our scene. This is our world. And we want to generate an image. Yeah, this image is that screen that we had in the examples before. But now we do not do a point projection like here, but instead we just parallelly project this cube onto our image. Yeah? And this parallel projection technically is difficult to generate. But on the computer, we can do that easily, and what we get is such an image. Yeah? And everything that is parallel remains parallel, so that's a very, very simple way to map a 3D object to a 2D world. What we want to have in the end, however, typically is a perspective projection, and looking or comparing it with this, the only difference is that whereas here all the projection rays are parallel, here all these projection rays converge in a single point. So that will be the eye or the camera. Yeah? But otherwise, it's exactly the same. Take a point, generate a projection ray towards the eye or a parallel one, compute where it intersects the image plane, and that gives the position here. Yeah? So these two are quite similar. And in fact, you can even imagine if you take that point and you move it further and further away, and you know moving to infinity is no problem with homogeneous coordinates, yeah, then these two become the same. Yeah? So they are very, very similar for now. Okay, so these are the two projections that we want to look at. And now it's interesting to look at, of course, if you are in a 3D world, typically, or surrounded by a 3D world, your camera will always only see a part of the world. Yeah? And this part of the world that gets projected onto your image is what we call the view volume. And for an orthographic projection, this view volume is pretty simple because it's a box, and potentially you could imagine that this box extends to infinity in this direction. Yeah? You can look as far as you want to. And the further objects are away, they don't change their size. You can really look as far as you want. So for an orthographic projection, the view volume is a box, potentially open here. For a perspective projection, this view volume looks more complicated, and in fact, it's a truncated pyramid. Yeah? And this is what we call frustum. That's just another expression for truncated pyramid. And yeah, our view volume now is this truncated pyramid that could also be potentially infinitely large, but in fact we will always have that back plane that kind of restricts our view volume, and we mainly have that for mathematical reasons. We will see that later. Okay, so view volume, either a box or this pyramid here. And using this notion of a view volume, now we can describe this process of viewing and projection as follows. So first of all, or using four steps. So step one is, this is what we call viewing, and that just means select the viewpoint and the view direction. Yeah? This defines the camera position, and we then transform our entire scene to a coordinate system relative to our camera. That's what we call viewing. And that's typically a rigid transformation, just a translation and a rotation, such that after that, the camera is in the origin, x and y span the image plane. Yeah. So in this example, we transform the entire world such that this is the x-axis, this is the y-axis, and that the view direction goes into this direction. Yeah? We just rotate the scene so that it's relative to our camera. That's all, nothing magic. Then, in the next step, we map, or now we somehow have to map our view volume to our image. Yeah? That's what we have here. This view volume and this view volume, we somehow have to map to this 2D image. Okay, and now something interesting is going on here, and that's when doing that mapping, we do not want to lose depth. That means if we map this point here to the image and this point, it might happen that they end up at the same point in the image, but we still want to have the information that this is further away than this one. We need that for occlusion. Yeah? So we somehow want to keep the depth information. So that means when mapping these points to image space, we do not only want to have the pixel position, but also information about how far this point is away. Yeah, we will need that for occlusion. So what we do, in fact, is that we take these view volumes, and we do not project them onto our 2D image, but we project them into a space where we have image coordinates, that's the pixel coordinates, and some value describing depth. And in fact, we get, again, a cube. Yeah? And this is called what we call the canonical view volume. And I can try to draw that here. And that's a good point for the end of the lecture to keep that in mind. So we can nicely draw that in 2D. So our view volume, OK, let's start with a simple one. If we have an orthographic projection, then this is our view volume. Yeah, this is our image plane. And this is our image. So that's the image plane. And what we want to do now is to map this to a cube, like this. Yeah. So this is, for instance, set direction. Here it's also set direction. Yeah, that comes from the viewing. And now it just stretches this part a little bit. So that's a quite simple operation, so that this point here is mapped to this, this point is mapped to this, and this to this. Yeah. So it's just non-isometric scaling. And so that point, for instance, ends up here. And if we did that transformation, yeah, then we can directly get the image coordinate. Yeah, so that's the point x, y, z. And then we immediately have this as image coordinate. Yeah, so that's the pixel position. And this is depth. This tells us how far this point is away from the image plane. Yeah, and if you have two points that both have the same x and y, yeah, then with depth you can determine this one is closer to the camera than this one, so this one will occlude this one. Okay? Good. Now you might say, okay, I mean that's crap, yeah? That mapping is boring. Why bother? Yeah, it gets interesting if we have perspective. Because now we do exactly the same. And we map this frustum here, now again to the unit cube, such that from here on we can proceed exactly like here. Yeah? So what we do is that we take this frustum, and we find a mapping that maps this point to this one, this point to this one, and this to this one. So that means, so obviously this is not affine. Yeah? We have to shrink objects in the back and to enlarge objects in front. Yeah? Perspective, objects in the distance get smaller. So this is not affine, but it's projective. Yeah? And the nice thing is now, if we have a point here that later on ends up here, yeah, we have, again, exactly the same property like up here. X and Y are the image position, and this is depth. Yeah? So from here on, yeah, we can just continue as we did up here. OK, and now I'm already 2 minutes over time. Sorry for that. Keep that in mind, and we will continue with that on Thursday. Thank you.